Welcome to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Melody Edwards. Today, we sit down for a civil discourse in the city of Gillette, where job layoffs, rising poverty, and hate speech has torn the community apart. We'll hear from two coal miners, one who supports Donald Trump, one who doesn't, and from a Hispanic community leader.
Well, he stopped my husband from coming into the States. And there was fear even with me doing everything right, the right way.
As part of our series, I Respectfully Disagree, a group of 10 people models better dialogue in Gillette.
It's really hard to demonize you when I have to look across the table at you, right? I mean, and I have to shake your hand. You can't do it because you realize, wait, we share a lot of things in common.
Join us for that conversation right here on Open Spaces on Wyoming Public Radio News.
Thanks for joining us for this special edition of Open Spaces. I'm Bob Beck. Today, as part of our series, I Respectfully Disagree, Wyoming Public Radio's Melody Edwards takes you on a journey into the heart of Wyoming's coal country, to the city of Gillette up in the northeast corner. Recently, it's become an intensely divided community. In the last election, Wyoming went in greater percentage to Donald Trump than any other state. But Campbell County supported Trump more than any other county in Wyoming, in a way that puts Gillette at the center of America's internal battle with itself. And it has a lot to do with the bust in the coal industry.
It became really tough, really scary. Everybody was worried about their jobs. It was time to either make drastic changes to your life or find something else.
That's Alec Lobb, one of two coal miners who joins us tonight. Lobb's a Trump supporter, but the other miner here, she's emphatically not. But there's a lot of other kinds of people assembling tonight, too. 10 altogether. All of them community leaders in one way or another. Faith leaders, politicians, social workers. Everyone piles plates of Italian food and pours glasses of pink lemonade. It's a small town, so many of these folks do know each other. We're here at the Rockpile Museum. Historic pioneer wagons sit nearby. A mannequin wears a coal miner's uniform. We all sit down to eat. First things first, I remind everyone of the four ground rules for civil discourse. To share speaking time equitably, to listen carefully and not interrupt, to keep an open mind, and to be respectful even if you don't respect someone's views. After that, we introduce ourselves. The chairman of the Campbell County Republicans starts us off.
Doug Gerard, I'm a software engineer. Ended up in Gillette because of my wife's job, who, if you don't know my wife, that's a good thing because she's an emergency physician. And so one of the nice things about Gillette for me is, you know, is my wife and I choose to live here. This is where we want to make our home. We don't have to be here. I mean, I can do my job anywhere, and she's in demand across the country, but we want to be here.
I'm Louise Carter King. I'm the mayor here in Gillette, and my family's been here since 1975. My dad was mayor in the 80s, and we've owned a business for 40 years now. I've got two kids, and I've still got, I believe, three siblings who still live here.
Alec.
I'm Alec Lobb. I'm a maintenance electrician at Bel Air Mine. I've been there as an electrician for 10. Worked for the company for 11. Grew up in southern Utah, actually. Joined the Navy and actually met a friend who was from the Buffalo Claremont area. Come out to visit one Christmas, fell in love with the area, the people, and made plans to move up here after my service. I've got two kids, they're 19 and 13. I enjoy Gillette because I've made a lot of friends here. It's a great community, pretty tight-knit. It's kind of centrally based because I'm an avid outdoorsman. It's kind of centrally based between the Black Hills and the Bighorns.
Great, thank you.
Okay, hi, I'm Leah Vader, and I've lived in Gillette since 1997, and I came here with my spouse, Lynn Huskinson, who's here, and she's a coal miner, and I was raised in Minneapolis, Minnesota. I was born in Kansas City, lived in Glendale Heights, Illinois for a while, but at 8 years old, moved to Minneapolis, went to University of Minnesota. But since I've been in Gillette, I've worked at the recycling center for 4 years. For the past 10 years, I've been a migratory worker. I work part of the year in Arizona, as a bald eagle nest watcher, wildlife biologist. And in the summer, last seven summers, I've been up from Dubois at Ring Lake Ranch, leading hikes at an ecumenical retreat center. So Wyoming to me is the outdoors, and Gillette is so beautifully nestled between the Black Hills and the Bighorns.
Yeah. Hi, I'm Lynn Huskinson. My dad moved here in 1977, my senior year of high school, which was a problem, but I'm a coal miner. I've worked at Bel Air a short time and then at Eagle Butte for 38 years. I've grown to really appreciate, you know, how accepting the community is.
I'm Tom Fisk. I'm the rector at Holy Trinity Episcopal Church. I've been in Gillette now for 11 years. I was born and raised in Santa Fe, New Mexico, and I've spent time in one of those sheep wagons. So I'm a Western kind of guy. Gillette has been, thank you for that, it's been a very open and friendly town. So now it's your turn.
My name is Jessica Diaz, and I'm not here to represent my job, but I do work for the school district as a student assistance coordinator. So I do a lot of assistance. I work with Father Tom, suicide prevention, drug and alcohol prevention. We do a lot of public health to the community. but I'm here to represent my Latino community, my Spanish speakers. I'm here to represent what we go through here in a sense of immigration. Some of us feel safe, some of us don't. I enjoy Gillette only because I help so many people and they need me. My husband doesn't like it very much because there's not much of a culture.
And what does he do?
He works for hot iron, mm-hmm. for construction and pipeline. And we have a son and we're expecting another.
Congratulations.
Next, Jenny Nell Hartung introduces herself.
Oh, I too am a Navy brat, but I was born and raised in Laguna Beach, California. My first bout with skin cancer, I decided I was heading north, so I went to Seattle. Seattle was going great. I was, you know, sort of between marriages, let's call it that. And I was coaching the United States equestrian team for people with disabilities. And I was driving the horse home because he was such a brat, he couldn't go with anybody else. He had to go alone, didn't play well with others. And I broke down on the side of the road in this little town called Rosette, Wyoming. And this guy stopped to help me that was coming home from hunting, and he had seven guns and a deer carcass in the back, and I was a vegan. And here's this vegan with this cowboy that stops to help me, and sort of one thing led to another. And I moved here about 6 months later. We have since gotten married, and we had a daughter through foster care that actually Jessica knows. We had her for a few years, and then we adopted her, and she has since graduated from high school, and she's going to the college. I'm a social worker, and I'm not here representing the Salvation Army, although I do work for the Salvation Army, but I've also worked in youth development here in town and at a couple different places, both teaching preschool to kids with disabilities, as well as working at a residential treatment facility here in town.
Right, thank you.
My name's Mark Englert. I'm the Vice President and CEO of Gillette College. I'm in my eighth year at the college. That's hard to believe how quickly that goes. I've been in the Northern Wyoming Community College District for 32 years, so most of my time was in Sheridan, but when the CEO of Gillette College got the presidency of the district, he afforded me the opportunity to come over here and take the leadership role of this campus, which has been the greatest career opportunity that I have ever had. It's just been incredible. However, I have announced my retirement in about a year because we've come to the point in our lives where it's time to share the remainder of it together.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
Senator? I am Michael Von Flader, and I'm the senator from Gillette. I came here about a year before Louise's dad. I think in 74 I got here. So I'm amazed. There's actually nobody at this table that is from Gillette.
I was born and raised here. I noticed that as well.
Yeah, everybody's come from somewhere else. Uh-huh. And so I came here because of a job. Uh-huh. Like everybody else, I was welding in the oil field. went to a coal mine, worked at Bel Air Mine. I am presently in my 13th year. Hopefully I'm good till 2020 unless I get, you know, impeached somewhere along the way, which we're hoping doesn't happen, but you never can tell.
When we come back, we share our stories of living in Gillette starting just before Donald Trump's election. The next task in our civil discourse is to weave all these very different stories together into a single narrative about Gillette's recent history.
I'm thinking that it might be good to start to kind of talk about what was going on in Gillette during the Obama years, when there was a lot more regulation of the energy industry starting to happen, and simultaneously natural gas prices were starting to compete with the price of coal. And, you know, just kind of give us an idea of what it was like during that time period.
Well, I could start it off here for a second. I would say in 2008, we actually peaked in about 10 or 12, I think was the highest price of coal. So in reality, from about 08 to about 12, it didn't matter who the administration was because we were doing so well. And the price of gas peaked in about 06 or 07. Everybody was employed. We couldn't really find enough people to employ. Mm-hmm. And then about 13 or 14, I think it was in 14, the leases went away as far as a ban on new coal leases because they wanted to revamp the program. So his first 4 or 5 years were really good for us. We were really booming. And then it caught up, and then the price of gas went so low. And it really was the price of natural gas going so low that hurt us.
Well, at that time, it was kind of difficult for everybody because, like I said before, it sounded like a personal attack towards coal miners as individuals when he said he was going to shut coal miners down. And so we were worried, but like Michael had said, coal sales were good in those first 4 or 5 years of his administration. But then the legislation caught up, and they started implementing their rules and regulations. Gas come down, and it all just kind of took effect all at once. So a lot of the coal miners and my fellow coworkers were worried. Usually one of the first things that a coal company does is they start making cuts, budget cuts. Manpower, equipment, how many coal sales they actually make. It became really tough, really scary. Everybody was worried about their jobs. The coal mine is a good, stable, working environment, usually. So there was a lot of my friends and everything that moved out of town.
Did you see people start to move? Yeah, Tom.
I understand that Gillette has always had a bust and a boom mentality. Even in the DSM-4, there is a diagnosis of Gillette syndrome. Really, there is.
That's hilarious.
For stress-related bust and boom anxieties. And so from my perspective, Gillette has always had that kind of we can do sort of attitude, regardless of the economic situation, because we've been in these bust and boom cycles.
He's right. There's always been, in the energy industry, that's just what it is. This last one, though, does seem like it was a perfect storm, because not only was natural gas down, oil down, and coal, but you had an administration who always also seemed like they were working against us. And I think that was hard on the long term. The city started about 7 years ago inviting congressional members from D.C. to come out here and tour a coal mine, our power plant, we had people ask us for masks. They thought they would need a mask when they were here. We had people ask if we cleaned our houses, washed our houses before they came. I mean, people had this misconception, and these are the people that are making our regulations. So when Trump got elected, he had been on our tour, and he was appointed to the EPA. And, you know, we finally got to see something because someone up in the administration actually had been here. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we felt no one else was helping us.
Yes. So, yeah, so then we saw this, that the coal industry really did tank. We saw just a huge number of layoffs. It was like 465 in a week. What was that like?
I'd like to address, I did not feel the panic that, you know, like, maybe it was because I'd been in the industry for so long, but I felt relatively calm. I knew people were going to lose their jobs. We didn't have the massive layoffs that, like, Black Thunder and North Antelope, but I didn't pick up on this huge fear. I wasn't like, I'm going to lose my job, because I'd had my job, and maybe I was complacent, but I'm more fearful of the administration right now. I was at ease with Obama because just being in the industry as long as I was, I was not going to go to work afraid all the time.
So when during the Obama years, you were okay with some of like the clean power plan, some of those things, they didn't concern you that you would, that might lead to you losing your job at some point?
The coal industry is a dying industry. Not going to be here. I don't see my coworkers 30 years at the same job.
So you kind of felt like that some of those regulations, maybe it was time for some of those? You were concerned about climate change?
Am concerned about climate change, yes, even though I'm a coal miner.
Well, one thing, I think there can be in 30 years people working in the coal market, because we have the integrated test center. I don't know if anybody knows about that, but it's what the governor put $15 million into, so that, and the XPRIZE came there. The XPRIZE is a foundation that gives prizes, millions of dollars, to whomever can come up with the best idea for coal and its byproducts, mainly carbon. I feel that just from that alone, there could be lots of other uses for coal and carbon. And we are sitting on 600 years of coal in the Powder River Basin. Why would anyone turn their backs on a plentiful, inexpensive resource like that?
Yeah, I agree. I think it will be in our future. I think the jobs will look very different, and how, you know, what extraction looks like and what automation is going to do to the industry.
Yeah.
You know, from the college perspective, one of the things that we witnessed with the big layoffs that we hadn't seen in other times is the mobilization of the states. So we're getting calls from the governor and the Department of Workforce Services, and they're mobilizing, coming up here, working with our folks, and we're basically triaging individuals who have been laid off and seeing if we can counsel them into other careers, if there are short-term programs that we might be able to provide that would assist them in securing other employment. So people say, well, you probably saw a big jump in enrollment. No, we've seen a steady increase in enrollment, but not from that population, from a population who thought maybe they would get jobs at the mines or in oil and gas, and those jobs are not available now. So they're coming to us, but not so much the people who lost the jobs or got severance pay.
Well, just one thing Michael said that's sticking with me is that,
sure,
you know, is about hating the administration, and it really wasn't for me. And for a lot of folks, I think it wasn't so much about hating the administration as just what's going to come next. What was, I just looked up a quote here.
Yeah.
Niemöller's, you know, said first they came for the socialists. Okay, Martin Niemöller. And he did nothing. It goes on and on. And it was, okay, so first they came for the coal miners. Well, what's next? If you don't toe the line on healthcare, what's going to happen to you now? What are they going to come after you? And because you don't do it the right way, so we want you out of here. And I think that people felt very persecuted and very, you know, and quite frankly, what else is going to happen? And in the Obama years, that was kind of, I think, the de rigueur, because, you know, we were all Bible-clutching gun owners that, God forbid, we actually stand up and say things and actually hold our positions. And that was I think, something that was more palpable than hating the administration. It's just, what's next? You know?
Yeah. Yeah.
And yet, I mean, I just want to say that the hate, you see racist flyers at the oil change place, you know, showing that this is a tar ball, you know, washing up on the beach, and it was Obama and Lindsay, racist, you know, very racist things. There was a float in the Holiday Light Parade in Gillette in 2012. I just looked up the picture. And I don't know why we're at the Light Parade. We didn't have kids or anything, but we were just down there like, you know, you feel good about that. And then it said, Buck Off Obama on a Holiday Light Parade float. Buck off, that was foul. There's kids here. It's like, this is not what this parade is about. And it seems to me that was real specific.
And unfortunately, I had invited Aftab Khan, who was unable to make it tonight because he was very ill. But he was part of opening up a mosque in town. And then very soon after, there was a Facebook page, Stop Islam in Gillette. And so there started to become some of this very racially charged language within the community. Can you guys kind of talk about your own perspectives on that time period?
Two summers ago, a Quran was burned at Camplex Park.
Yes, yeah.
And that distinguishes a community in a way that I wouldn't want to be distinguished. Gillette Against Hate formed, and I've been busy with them. And we are doing a Holiday Light Parade float co-sponsored with the Salvation Army, and our float is Neighbors Helping Neighbors, then and now. And just to emphasize that this community has always been multiracial. The Khans are part of, they're Americans. They're part of this community. Generations are beautiful. Spanish-speaking community at St. Matthew's and throughout the community. You know, that's who we are, and hopefully, but that was a very jarring event, and it still needs to be in the forefront.
It sounds to me like it's not the actual community people that are doing these things, because everybody that I've spent time with, they're not those type of people. They'll help, whether they're Hispanic, African American, even AFTAB. I actually worked for AFTAB when I first moved to Gillette for a while, but it doesn't sound like it's what Gillette is, because the people that I spend time with at the bowling alley, at the archery range, I even go out to the new gun club and shoot. And yeah, we're gun-toting rednecks from Wyoming, if you wanted to be that way. But we will still stop and help. Doesn't matter who it is. We see somebody in trouble, we will stop and
I think
help.
That was a real minority of people that came up. And how you saw it was the protests that they would organize. There'd be three times.
Right. Exactly.
The other side protesting against them. So it was just those, they were just so ugly, you know, that what they said, that I think it just, you know, just rang horrible with us. But for the most part, I just think the majority of people who live in Gillette are very welcoming.
I'm certainly not arguing that point, but to the one person that experiences something, I mean, all we ever had was go back to Canada written in our car in the dust after we got a nice Canadian equality marriage in 2006. Like, oh, we were only there just to get married. But I don't ever want to discount what the effect is on a young child in a classroom that hears, you're going to get deported now. He's elected. You're going to get deported now. And young people hear that in classrooms. And it may not come up at the archery range or the gun club, but it comes up at a Gillette Against Hate meeting where a teenager might feel comfortable saying, yes, there's kids that celebrate Hitler's birthday at Campbell County High School. There's Confederate flags displayed.
I totally agree with you guys. That when you don't socialize with a different culture, you don't understand their pain. And yes, there has been a lot of times where students do come up and say, make America great again. And then they talk about how they're being discriminated because of their color. We have felt very discriminated. There has been raids where people just hide in Gillette, where people hide because they're afraid that if they're going to be stopped at Walmart, they're going to be asked for documentation.
because of their color. So then they get people who are citizens like myself. They seek our help and they say, Jessica, can you go out and see if there is ICE here, if there's immigration enforcement here? For 3 years, 2-3 years, there was raids where we had to hide for 3 days in our homes before school or during school time. And it was scary, it was sad, it was, we were afraid. There was maybe 50 families here.
Yeah, and so, you know, maybe we have moved up in time to when Donald Trump was campaigning and then he was elected. And I think that there was a sense of excitement that a new president was going to help with some of the economic problems. And maybe there was a sense that, you know, some of these immigration issues, I know that there was a lot of people that were hoping for him to build a wall. And so I just wonder if you can talk a little bit about that time period. And maybe from your point of view, especially Jessica, what that was like to be living in Gillette when Donald Trump was elected and was using this kind of rhetoric that maybe was a little scary for the Hispanic community.
Yeah, I think I brought my husband into the States. It took 6 entire years. So I like to joke around that I've had 8 honeymoons because I would go visit him. I would go visit him, and I was fortunate enough for that because not many people have honeymoons. But, I mean, during that time, I thought, is he going to stop? Start crying. Well, sorry. I mean, I do so much for our community. And I thought, will he stop my husband from being here? So much I do for our people, for our citizens, for us. So much that I do. Will he stop my husband from coming into the States? And there was fear even with me doing everything right, the right way. They had told us on our final process, it'll take 3 to 6 months for him to be here. And another, back in the years, it was within a month you were being approved or denied. And so my husband, it was 3 months and there was nothing. It was 6 months and there was nothing. Again, that discrimination for my other people, my people, for our people, it's our people. Yeah. There came discrimination between that. And I thought, if I am afraid, what about those that are here who are trying to seek something better for themselves? And then it took 6 months, 7 months, 8 months. After 10 months, I thought, am I going to have to go back to Mexico to have a life out there? And then finally, with so much prayer, so many of you guys, my husband was able to come into the States. He was approved after 11 months.
At my little office, my little service unit, we have no need for a social security number. If somebody needs help, they come in and they ask for help. If a family comes to us and says they're hungry, we give them food. It's our responsibility. But then there came this sort of dark cloud, and we had people hiding in cars and sending friends in to get mm-hmm. food mm-hmm. that had social security numbers. It's not even on the form. So we've been able to start a dialogue, and we have our form in Spanish, and we've been able to send a form out that says, it's okay if you come in, you're safe here. For about 5 or 6 months, it was pretty dark and it was hard to have the conversations. Mm-hmm. But I feel like we're breaking through. I feel like the community has come together and we are nurturing and loving these people and trying to help them feel safe.
We've kind of talked a little bit about the issue of homelessness mm-hmm. and poverty. How's that going in the community of Gillette right now?
I estimated helping 930 individuals for this last fiscal year that we just ended. And that's what I budgeted for. 1,660 people were actually helped, almost double what I had budgeted for, which was up 200 from the year before. So our numbers have really steadily gone up and up. So many wonderful, benevolent people in this town. I've never met more generous people than I have met in Campbell County. I mentioned to you when we first came in that we're the only bell ringers in the whole western states that are all volunteer. 3,000 hours of volunteer service to ring the bell to raise money for us. And everybody just gives their time. You know, times are tough.
But that's Gillette. That is Wyoming to me, because that pioneer spirit is still mm-hmm. with us, that, you know, you help your neighbor because tomorrow it could be you.
Exactly.
And you don't do it out of self-interest, it's just out of community interest, right. It seems. And that's one of the great things about living here. I mean, I grew up on the East Coast, and you go to a city, you know, you walk down the street, somebody sees a bum on the street, somebody steps over them, and somebody should do something about this. And that's the end of it. And they expect their government to come in and solve it. Here, it's the citizens that do it.
Stay tuned. The conversation next turns to a controversial vote to raise taxes and how it deeply divided the community. You're listening to a special edition of Open Spaces about a civil discourse in Gillette. 10 community leaders from all walks of life sat down at the Rockpile Museum to break bread. Here, they discuss a divisive vote last month on a tax increase.
So one of the things that's really been, you know, on the minds of everybody in Wyoming is the possibility of, as we've, you know, had this crunch and this energy downturn, is the idea of raising taxes. And I know that that the city of Gillette kind of tossed around the idea of a quarter cent tax. For Wyomingites who don't know what the quarter cent tax was, can somebody kind of explain that? And then can we talk a little bit about how the conversation went around the quarter cent tax?
Dr.
Abel, we're all looking at that. We all know you know.
How long is this recording?
Give us your in a nutshell.
No, the quarter percent tax initiative was an initiative to really secure a dedicated funding mechanism for the college. For those who don't understand our college, we are very unique in this, and we're part of a district. Sheridan is the taxing county. And I tell people this a lot, that this is probably the only community college in the country that's grant funded. And our growth just does not allow us to continue to operate that way. So we've had dialogue with community leaders and state leaders for decades about, you know, what it would look like to have a dedicated funding mechanism to support our college, support operations of this college. And we finally settled on this quarter percent. It's an economic development tax. We are certainly an economic development engine and driver for the community. It was a means to support, hopefully, efforts to diversify an economy, to get us out of that boom and bust cycle, because I don't know that we can necessarily endure another bust like we just went through. So we looked at it, and we had a community conversation. That's what we asked. If, you know, put it before the public, have a community conversation, and see whether or not they would be willing to tax themselves a quarter of one penny to support higher education.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, in my mind, it failed.
Yeah.
So, you know, we're back to the drawing board, but it was a very bad three-letter word.
So I want to throw out a question with that. If we're such a helping community and we do help each other, why is it that we didn't get that? Because I think about it and I'm like, whoa, this is a great opportunity for our students, for everybody. Why did we not get that?
I can probably answer that, because
yes,
you know, I was vocal on the no side for a number of different reasons, but principally because the tax wasn't just for the college.
Right.
It would have had over, you know, $1.5 to $2 million a year going to economic development, which has done some things in the town, but hasn't done enough to justify that kind of investment. It also would have put in jeopardy the 1% tax that we're going to have on the ballot next go around. And that 1% tax, those funds actually do a lot of good. And I'd argue then, and Dr. Englert and I probably go back and forth on this, but that the tax itself wasn't necessarily the right funding mechanism because it was going to be on the ballot every 4 years, I think. And how, if the community's not doing well and needs to get rid of a tax, what happens when you lose that money if you're expecting $4 million a year that you're not going to have? What's going to happen to the college then? We need to find a better way to fund that.
What's your suggestion then?
I would have a couple of suggestions. One, there's still part of a mill that's not levied by the county right now on property taxes that could go directly to the college. They could go there. We ought to honestly look at being our own community college district, which would take a lot of change. And there's lots of Michael shaking his head no, because it would take a lot of legislative stuff, and it just isn't going to happen.
Doug, I would argue you said that you could do your job anywhere.
Yes.
Right? Because you telecommute,
sure.
I'm assuming. And what about all the folks that have been laid off from oil and gas and will maybe continue to be laid off from those fossil fuel industries? And they have no college and they have nothing to fall back on. What about them? Very expensive to go out of town to go to school. Oh, their families are here.
Without question. You're right. And I don't think that, you know, one of the first things that I did is that, you know, I'm sad that the tax failed to the college because, you know, I would have liked to support it, but I just didn't think it was the right method to do it. And so we have to find a better, different way to fund it.
As a voter scratching one's head in the polling booth, I was really confused as to what the 0.25% sales tax was going to do. Had the initiative been for the college, I think it would have passed 100%. But when it was splitting hairs, from my perspective, that's where the killed the.
I don't think so. I think no matter what, the no voters would have been out. I just think it would have failed.
That's my sense too. I agree with the mayor that the reality is that there is a significant vocal no tax contingent, which you know we're just going to have to deal with. And you talk about civil discourse. This is a whole new era of dialogue, civil discourse occurring behind the computer screen. And honestly, it lost civility. Mm-hmm. It really did. So, you know, from an educational perspective, if we learn anything from this, we ought to learn how we educate others to participate in civil discourse using social media.
Right.
Do you think that it'd fly again at some point? And then, you know, maybe next year or the year after?
You know, maybe not a special election. That would at least got more voters out.
Right, yeah.
And I do think a lot of the no vote, I mean, of course, more no votes got out this time. And maybe if you had it during a general election.
Yeah. And what Mark said about the civil discourse on the computer screen was very rapid, and you know, and there was stuff in there that just absolutely was not true on the computer screen.
Coming up, the group articulates a shared vision for Gillette's future. Everyone takes a break to get a piece of cheesecake, and we turn to the question of how to bring the community together in the future.
Actually, I'm hearing a lot of agreement, and so if we could articulate where we agree, in some ways, what you have heard people saying, and places that you are feeling like, actually, we do share some values, we share a certain vision for what we want from our community. Anybody care to start trying to put into words what it is that this group of people shares in terms of their vision for Gillette?
I guess I'm filtering it through my ears, but I'm also hearing an agreement that as leaders in the community, we will go forward pushing back on the rhetoric of fear in town and that kind of discrimination that places on people.
What I'm hearing is it sounds like everybody's in agreement that the Gillette community is a strong community and will persevere through whatever changes might come. And I think that's a good thing, whether immigration being one thing, I know that's always been an issue for years.
Forever.
But the history of this country was founded on immigration.
Exactly.
And right. That is not a bad thing.
It's an awesome thing.
We are not all from, our bloodlines are not all from the United States.
Thank you for that, because that's so true. That's something that I wanted to speak about. But I think what happens is we don't speak about it enough, that people don't understand it or that there is a need for it. But I think if we can speak about it to our legislators, to those to say, hey, we do need help. We are founded on immigration, and it's not a bad thing.
So what I'm hearing is that you guys agree on the need to make people feel safe in your community.
Yes.
Finding
yes.
a way to
yes.
make people feel safe.
Yes.
Other ways that you can do that, either you personally or your institutions, your nonprofits.
The biggest thing is just give them the information. Make sure that people are going to make their own conclusions anyway, but if you give them all of the information, that's going to be the best way that you're going to show them this is how it should be, this is what you have. You're going to draw your own conclusions. Everybody is. It's free will. But if you get it out there, they're going to make the decision. I bet you anything, more than likely, just judging from the group at this table, we all have very similar mindsets, and I'll bet you money the community has the same.
The best thing you can do is get people to sit down and talk to each other. I mean, that's one of the things that, you know, within the GOP, one of the things I've been trying to do is get people to come. Come. If you disagree with us, all the more reason to come and be there. If you're a Republican, if you don't like what's going on, because we need to hear your opinion. But it has to be like we are here, face to face, because it's really hard to demonize you when I have to look across the table at you, right? I mean, and I have to shake your hand. You can't do it, because you realize, wait, we share a lot of things in common. And that's, you know, Michael and I disagree on a lot of stuff, but he is one of the politicians that I look up to more than anybody, because he will stand up and tell me exactly where he stands and do it even when it's not in his best political interest, which I think is a very, very rare thing. You know, and so people, we need more people to have that kind of courage.
Well, thank you for that, Doug, but
I'm
not sure I carried. Yeah, that was kind of a shameless plug, wasn't it? You need my campaign manager next time?
Like I said, we disagree, remember?
I forgot about that little aspect. But if I can switch gears for just a minute here.
Fine.
One of the things I've noticed, and Doug can attest to this too, is the fact that our social clubs, our civic clubs, are losing membership.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you go to the Rotary Clubs, you go to the Lions Clubs, whatever, they have 8 or 12 or 18 maybe main people that show up pretty much every week or every other week. Well, when I first joined Rotary, we had 50-some regular members that came every time. 40 was a bad week. Now it's like 12.
Yeah. You know, we've talked a little bit about economic diversification. What can we do? What are some of the irons that are in the fire right now? What are some solutions there?
Melody, one of the things that we talked quite a lot about during the campaign was the role education plays in diversifying the economy. You generate an educated workforce. Gillette is a profoundly strong blue-collar community, hardworking, technically skilled employees, but still singularly focused on a particular segment of the economy, extraction industry. What we have to do is take that same blue-collar, highly technically skilled workforce and help them become entrepreneurs. Small businesses, 25 to 50 employees. We have all the things that you need: rail, air, and interstate. And smart, hardworking people. Who's stepping up next? And if my kids and my kids' kids, if they don't have that for my grandkids and great grandkids, they will go somewhere else to find it. And that's the bottom line. It will happen, and we won't be able to stop it.
Right.
Yeah. I see that, and I see some positive things with what the mayor was saying about, you know, keeping coal going in some context. Gillette remaining an energy capital. I love it, the energy capital. Well, there's so much diversification in energy. It can go on through coal. It can go on through, we live in a palatial 1970 single wide that we just love. It's out, it's got sun. It can have, you know, solar panels on the roof, you know, and we're not doing the kind of things that could add in, that could be innovative.
What are you thinking we can do? What are some solutions for this problem, like you have mentioned, of social media, the willingness, because you're masked, to say things that aren't civil? And in a small town, that can be really wounding. What are some solutions to get people to unmask themselves from social media and face each other and get to talking?
We have a lot of great, very small, though, organizations in town. We have PFLAG, we have Gillette Against Hate, we have the County GOP, we have the Campbell County Dems, we have Living Blue in Campbell County. But we have these organizations that we can get together. Wouldn't it be fun if we all got together at the Camplex one day and had, you know, bring your organization to the Camplex Day or something, and we all just, like, came together and had a, I don't know, popcorn and a candy cane. I don't know, something.
I was reading an article the other day about a student dispute on a college campus, and I can't remember the campus. Anyway, the war was being waged online, and what the students said was, all right, that's enough. We're going to put the phones down and shut the computers off for the week, and we're going to come together, and we're going to address the issue. And that's that generation that's going to make the call. Because I can stand in a faculty meeting, or I can stand in a staff meeting, or I can go tell faculty to tell their students to XYZ. But until the generation that's using it steps up and says, let's drop it for a while and get together and have the face-to-face, it will become an infection.
I don't think it's generational. I think it's actually just anybody. Once you can anonymize yourself, boy, people let things go. You know, so much today, we're all busy. I mean, how difficult was this to put together?
Yeah.
Okay. I mean, there's only, 12 of us here? You know, to get everybody to take time out and go talk to your neighbors and that kind of thing, which is, you know, quite honestly, is one of the nice, unique things about Gillette is for me in Wyoming. I know my neighbors, and we get along. But getting folks to talk to each other and just take that step away is going to be the hard part. I mean, this 0.25% tax is, I know you won't agree with this, but as small an issue as it really was, I mean, because it's really not that much money we were really talking about. Mm-hmm. Daggers were drawn. And I was just put off by it, honestly. I was really kind of, it was really kind of a sad thing to see. We need to have people talk more face-to-face and stop villainizing just somebody. You're not evil just because you disagree with me, you mm-hmm. know? And so many people don't think like that these days. Right. If you're of this tribe, you're wrong.
Right.
you're an evil person.
We can agree to disagree agreeably.
Yep.
Right. We can do that.
It seems to me the administrators of whatever the Facebook group is, you know, has responsibility and culpability in allowing that kind of thing to go on. And you just remove posts that aren't okay. I mean, I run a group for something else I'm involved in that's nationwide, and I have to look at every single thing before it goes out there because there's kids on my group, mm-hmm. you know, and that's how that goes. So, I mean, why not just be more responsible as Facebook page owners, yeah. you know, whatever we are.
Yeah. Reactions to this discussion. Anything that you guys would like to say in terms of what you know, how this went, how it could have been improved, what did you learn?
When you have these conversations, because we are all sharing the responsibility of, mm-hmm. of raising the next generation of leaders.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So where are the 25-year-olds sitting around this table?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, good point.
Because they have voice, too, yeah. and we ought to hear that.
Yeah.
I'm going to be honest. I'm going to talk about the elephant in the room. I was a little nervous coming. Yeah. I was like, oh, gosh, we're going to get in a big fight about, you know, Obama versus Trump. Like, what's going to happen? But, you know, the break bread idea and the whole communal feel. And it was a lovely conversation. And I got to know everybody here better. And I really enjoyed everybody's point of view. And if I see you on the street, I'll give you a hug or something. Because that's what I do.
Even if we don't ring the bell, right?
Yes, Michael, I'll let you off the hook this year.
All right. right. Well, thank you all so much.
Thank you
for coming.
It was great. Yeah. Congrats.
As people pull on their coats, the Salvation Army's Jenny Nell Hartung encourages everyone to volunteer for bell ringing.
Just in case you want to sign up for bell ringing before I leave, look right now.
Several people gather around to sign up. They might not agree on much this bunch, but they do agree on serving their community. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Melody Edwards.
I'm Bob Beck, and you've been listening to a special edition of Open Spaces, part of an ongoing series we call I Respectfully Disagree with Wyoming Public Radio's Melody Edwards. You can watch a video of this conversation on our website at wyomingpublicmedia.org. And while you're there, you can also hear more of these civil conversations or suggest a future one. Open Spaces is a production of Wyoming Public Radio News.